Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jan, your host, and I hope you guys had a wonderful spring semester as school is coming to an end, especially if you're a senior. And this week's episode will be featuring a guest, Professor Jan Blanchard, and I hope you guys learn something new as she talks about autism and how the field has grown from the 80s and 90s to present time. So I hope you guys enjoy this week's episode, and I'll see you at the end.
Hi, my name is Jan Blatcher. We're at the University of California, Riverside, and at UCLA in the Department of Psychology. But I'm now what's called a Distinguished Research Professor. I'm retired, but I was hired back to continue to supervise doctoral students. I run the Search Autism Center at UC Riverside, and I manage several large research grants and supervise the teams on them. So that's what I do. One of those half-time jobs that's really a full-time job. I basically retired from teaching, which required, you know, those specific times to drive to Riverside or to be on. And I'm doing what I love most, working with students, doing research.
That's amazing. So to begin with the first question, it's very general, so you can take this anywhere you'd like. How do you think psychology is correlated with education and teaching students?
Well, correlated threw me off a little bit, but certainly what we learn in psychology classes and, you know, people define psychology in many different ways, but let's talk about it as learning about people, the way they think, the way they feel, the way they act. That is certainly related to the process of teaching. And in my particular line of research, which is with autistic children, families, autistic college students, it's particularly pertinent, which is why I agreed to speak with you. I study student-teacher relationships in the context of autism. So, you know, how do teachers of young children with autism in their general ed classes, I'm not talking special ed teachers, I'm talking about, for the most part, young autistic children, say, ages 4 to 7, how do teachers include them? How do they perceive them? How do they react to them? And we can actually use the tools of psychology to measure that. I'll stop there and see if we're on the same track.
Yes, that's perfect. So to branch off of what you said, what made you interested on focusing autistic children? Because it's obviously not a very vast research topic. So what made you realize, oh, this is what I want to do?
Well, for people, you know, that aren't in the field, it might seem like a kind of designer disorder. But as of last week, the Center for Disease Control has decided that autism now occurs in 1 in 36 children. And that is, you know, that really means that every teacher of general ed students is going to have autistic children in his or her class, okay? And particularly young children. So it's much less of a rare disorder, and it is something that general ed teachers feel like they're not trained to deal with or be equipped to deal with. And it's particularly relevant at the early ages, which is why I study what I do. And I can go down that rabbit hole and explain to you about student-teacher relationships and how they're very predictive, and here's where the psychology comes in, how what happens between a teacher and a young child early on is it foretells the relationship of that child with teachers in middle school and even upper school. And there have been studies, not mine, that have looked at children in kindergarten and first grade and found that those who had a warm and positive relationship with their teacher were less likely to be delinquent later on, to drop out of school, to do better academically, and do better socially with their peers. Now you have kids with autism who enter school somewhat deficient in social skills to begin with, right? And teachers who aren't generally prepared to work with them and you have kind of a rocky start. You asked why I got interested in this. I've been working in the field for 40 years, and you know, back in the 80s and 90s, the interest in autism just exploded. And prior to that time, I was interested in families who had children with disabilities, and we didn't label them so much. And as it turned out, about a third of all the families that I studied over the years did have children with autism. So I began tapping that data set and writing some cute papers about that. Fast forward, I've had a number of federal grants, primarily around this issue of inclusion early on, and looking at early kids as well as adolescents and the transition to adulthood also in autistic youth.
So you mentioned how if kids are in a school environment with warm, like welcoming teachers, they're less likely to develop autism or feel like they're not heard. So because obviously they're in school 5 days a week and like 8 hours a day now, teachers make a big impact. And I think a lot of teachers now don't realize how big of an impact it is. And especially because it is more prominent and like more people are aware that autism is a thing now. And it's not, and it's officially like a label, like you said before in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't that the education aspect of when teachers receive their degree, it hasn't been updated in a sense, right?
Right. I don't think regular ed teachers or general ed teachers are prepared enough for it. You know, they used to think, you know, I wonder if I'll have a child with autism in my class. Now it's a question of when they will have a child in their class. So let me tell you a few things that we found out. We found out through a series of studies that I won't bog you down with the details, but different populations, different studies, that young kids with autism, again, kindergarten, first, second grade, had teachers who reported more conflict and less positive relationships with them, even more negative than the relationship with children with intellectual disability, a different kind of disability, and of course, more negatively than neurotypical or typical children. And that really concerned us. You know, how could these little kids enter school and already have teachers who, when given the measure of student-teacher relationship developed by my colleague Bob Pianta at the University of Virginia, a very reliable, interesting measure, how can this be such clear-cut? I mean, these differences are statistically significant. So though my colleague and co-investigator, Dr. Abby Eisenhower at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and I decided to study this systematically with funding from the Institute of Education Sciences. That's a federal agency. And we looked at, for 4 or 5 years, we looked at what are the correlates and consequences of having high functioning autism, you know, kids going into regular ed schools. And what relates to a good transition? What makes them feel included? And then after those years, we realized this concept of student-teacher relationship just jumped out. So we wrote another grant for 4 years to IES to develop a teacher intervention around this notion of student-teacher relationships. And that grant is just wrapping up, and we're hoping to hear whether a follow-up grant will be funded. But the grant that's wrapping up was a randomized controlled trial of the effectiveness of our intervention, which we call smooth sailing, helping young kids sail smoothly into school. Our intervention was really proved, smooth sailing was proved to be effective. Teachers could improve the quality of their relationships with their autistic students. This intervention was only 12 weeks long. Only about 4 weeks long, a total of about 12 hours. And even that could make a difference.
Wow.
I can tell you more about it if you want, or maybe you want to take this conversation in a different direction.
Oh, of course. So I just want to make a comment. Because like education has been established for decades, it's also a very, I guess, kind of traditional way of how the education board handles things. And because autism, like you said, by the CDC, it's finally not just a label for children that are hyper, because this like notion and around hyper kids that don't just sit quietly while they do work, even though they're 5 years old, it's caused everyone, especially teachers, to have a bias. And instead of treating the kid as if any other kid or any person they know, they unconsciously treat them differently, which in mindset is a huge thing, but it's also a very hard thing to change. But education, and like you said, it only took 4 weeks and 12 hours, being able to just have the teacher sit down and learn about it for a couple of weeks can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously there were a lot of steps in this intervention and a lot of other things they learned in it. But in a nutshell, that's it. I mean, when you talk about kids who are hyper, we're talking about ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that is also a form of neurodiversity, like autism. And very similar, it's funny you raise that. I mean, similar in terms of teachers struggling a little bit. However, they can put a label to that. I'm not saying it's right that they struggle with kids with ADHD, but what our intervention does is help teachers understand that what they see as annoying behaviors or bad or disruptive behaviors are really just part of this disability. And genetically, I mean, it's wired in. And so it's not necessarily the child's fault. I can give you an example here. So you're not Zooming this, but you know, I observed one child who had a pencil in his hand. He kept banging it on the table. It's what's called the repetitive behavior. And that was his behavior. And while I was observing, the teacher came over and whispered in my ear, "See, he does that just to annoy me." And of course, that wasn't the time for me to speak to the issue. We did that later, but she was impugning a bad motive, a disruptive motive to the child who really didn't even know that he was doing something that was annoying the teacher.
Yeah, because if the teacher always tells it to herself and she doesn't kindly intervene or tell the child, "Hey, I know this may help you right now, but it can be disruptive to other classmates. Maybe we could make like lower the volume or slow it down instead, so it's not as disruptive." Because they keep it to themselves or they only talk badly to like their coworkers, for example, it just builds up because they're so fixated on it.
That's right. And I mean, to bring this back to, you know, your notion of psychology, I think it's the constructs that underlie a lot of what we study in this student-teacher relationship context. You know, when we talk about social-emotional development or teacher perception of the student, in our new work, we're going to start actually getting more child perceptions of the teacher in subsequent studies. We haven't done much of that. We only have one direct study of these young kids where that we talk to them about loneliness. And it's palpable. I'll never forget the kindergartner with autism who told us, "Kindergarten is the loneliest place on earth." So, you know, there's much to be studied and looked at, even at the level of these little types.
It's so sad. There's in kindergarten and they already have the mindset that school isn't a good place and it should be welcoming.
Right. So that you know, gives you a lot of motivation and passion with the work that we were doing. Mm-hmm. You have something like that. Do you have other questions that you'd like me to address?
So when I was reading your bio, there was something called SEARCH in capital letters. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. SEARCH is an acronym support, education, advocacy, resources, community, hope. That's what SEARCH stands for. And it was, you know, a consultant who came up with the term after she determined what we do. And it's an autism center in the School of Education at the University of California, Riverside. And when we started in 2008, we were really the only autism center in the entire Inland Empire of Southern California that dealt with, we were one of very few that did any kind of autism screening or assessment, but we were the only ones that dealt with education, of following families through the process of getting early intervention and setting them on sort of a path to obtaining an appropriate education for their children. And at the time, we were the only center that targeted minority families or low-income families, because our services are no cost and available in Spanish and English. Regrettably, no other languages, but we're struggling to get enough trained assessors even in Spanish. But another uniqueness of SEARCH is that it's a community collaborative with the School of Education, this no-cost model. And so we use it as a living laboratory to train graduate students who want to come in, learn about autism, learn about the phenomenology of autism, like see autistic little kids. So we train them in the gold standard autism assessments so that they can learn how to do the assessments under the guidance of myself and the assistant associate director, Catherine Stavropoulos. And so it's a very, it's a learning laboratory for graduate students.
That's another factor of like autism, is that a lot of low-income families, they may realize that they actually have autism or just brush it off because they feel like, I can't pay that bill, I can't send like my children to get evaluated, and that just like causes it to continue in that family.
That's very true. I mean, we are catching up study after study, you know, ones we've done and ones colleagues of mine have done are showing, obviously we've identified why some BIPOC families or families of color have not gotten the autism services that they should. And now we are targeting that. But it's going to take time to catch up. You know, we have all these little kids that should have been identified at age 2 or 3, or God forbid, age 4, getting identified at 5, 6, 7, and 8. So, you know, there's still a need out there, particularly, as I said, in inland Southern California, which is only, you know, 90 miles from LA, which is a mecca of autism services. And it is truly a desert, you know, literally and figuratively, in the Inland Empire.
Yeah. And like you were saying how it's only 90 miles away from California. And California, it's so densely populated, and there's so many tech companies, and there's all of this all right there. And because it's such a major city, when people think of California, they're like, oh, LA. And they don't take into account other cities and how even just the rural parts of even just LA can be way different than they expected.
Yeah, no, it's very true. You've all heard of the Coachella Valley Music Festival, I'm sure. You know, it's this shishi festival that takes place in one of the poorest communities in Southern California. So, you know, and particularly poor and deficit in health services in general, medical and health services, but particularly in services for children with autism.
And so, to branch off what you said, like Coachella, because it's posted everywhere on social media, people also associate like Coachella with like this beautiful, well-constructed, lit-up concert stage, right? But because it's edited and it's only a photo or like a 10-minute clip, people don't even realize that everyone set that up. That area isn't funding that, so they're not receiving profit from it. It's who sets it up.
Yeah, there is a lot of pressure now on the promoters of Coachella to start giving back to the community. But you don't see, you know, there should be centers and healthcare centers and hospital wings with names of these promoters, and you don't see that. Most of the money goes in their pockets.
Yeah. And even though there's multiple researchers like Hugh who receive grants, that's only funding for one research. And even though findings are very important, they're not always funding those certain areas that are low income that need healthcare that could boost their well-being and eventually even boost their income if they're healthy and able to work higher paying jobs.
That's right. That's right. But one reason the federal government funds studies like mine and many other people's is that they want to control the environment to study a phenomenon, or if it's an intervention, to find out what works and what doesn't and for whom it works. And so that's a different kind of funding than providing services sort of on a broad scale. And you don't want to provide services that don't have a scientific evidence base. So I think the two work hand in hand. And that's true for a lot of aspects of psychology. You know, developing evidence-based practices is really what the field is striving for.
Got it. And then the other things you mentioned about search is provided in Spanish and English, and you hit that even Spanish is hard to find translators. I think another important thing is because there's so many immigrants in the United States, it's not just Caucasian people, so it's not just English spoken anymore. And when there's densely populated Asian communities, Hispanic communities, their cultures weren't aware of all these medically based term facts that are implemented in the U.S. So that also doesn't help the translators needed to these low-income families.
No, it's true. Although the statewide agencies called regional centers do provide services in numerous languages. Some of them, I know the number of languages is probably up around 11. It's very difficult once you get out in the field to provide the professionals to be able to do all that.
Yeah. Because you said search was established in 2008 and it was even hard to find Spanish, was there Spanish translators? Would you have, if you could improve it now, what other languages would you include?
Well, let me just correct your prelude. It wasn't hard to find Spanish speakers. It's because we're this community university collaborative and graduate students do a lot of work with us. It's important that we recruit, you know, Spanish-speaking graduate students who want to work in the field of autism. And in fact, the field of autism has been, quite frankly, so very white. And in fact, until recently, all the famous films, all the media, everything, you know, portray, you know, white faces. And, you know, I produced a film that's another whole podcast, but we were proud that it's called Autism Goes to College. And we were proud that 60% of the subjects we featured were non-white. So that's important. What languages would I say? I think it would vary on part of the state, right? I mean, East LA has Spanish and probably three or four different other Asian languages, you know, Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese. In the Inland Empire, we have smaller percentages of those populations. But again, the schools and the regional centers are required to have translators.
Okay.
We just, you know, sometimes we don't need it. You know, the children learn some English at school and our assessments of the child can be done in English. And it really doesn't matter whether the parent speaks English or not. But the parents do have measures to complete. So we have been restricted to English and Spanish. And I would love to see more graduate students coming in who are able to help us expand the reach to families who speak other languages. And for that matter, to become autism professionals. I'm really proud that we have we attract a lot of good graduate students, and you know, we try very hard to get a diverse staff at Search.
That's amazing. I didn't know you produced, like, helped with the film too.
Yeah, that's probably a separate podcast. In fact, Autism Goes to College is the name of the film. I'll send you that link. www.autismgoestocollege.org. And there you'll see over 20 podcasts by the same name that are produced by and with our autistic college students.
Awesome. Thank you.
Listening to both.
I will definitely listen to that. That sounds very interesting. Thank you so much to Professor Jan Blanchard for taking her time to provide her insight into this field. And I hope you guys enjoy this episode as much as I did, and that you have a wonderful rest of your day, morning, night, evening, whenever you're listening to this podcast. And I'll see y'all next time.